President Trump can't find the rule of law with two hands. And he does not put people around him who value the rule of law. So Democratic attorneys general are forced to act. But we do so with the expectation that attorneys general are the people's lawyers. And if the Republican administration, if they are going to step on the rights of American citizens and citizens in our Democratic AG states, then they're going to respond. That's who they are.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Sean Rankin is the executive director of the Democratic Attorneys General Association. He runs the day-to-day of the organization charged with the political support of our state attorneys general, who are the people's lawyers in the states and a key bulwark against Trump and the Republicans at this moment in political time. Sean has been a political operative and campaign consultant for many years. I think we are lucky to have him breathing new life into the Democratic Attorneys General Association. When you listen to Sean, you will see that he is a well-prepared leader who has found an important way to contribute to the party and the country. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, please listen to my conversation with Sean Rankin, Executive Director of the Democratic Attorneys General Association.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
My name is Sean Rankin. I'm the executive director at the Democratic Attorneys General Association. I've been in and out of politics for almost 25 years. I love politics. That's why I always come back. Sometimes I need a break. When I've been out of politics, I earned my MBA, worked with a number of startups, spent some time in venture capital and private equity. Largely that was international. And I've enjoyed traveling and helping people launch businesses and grow organizations. So for me, coming in at the Democratic Attorneys General Association at a time when they were transitioning from a part-time committee to a full-time committee, it really was the marriage of everything I love about startups with politics. So affectionately, it was called politicalstartup.com. That's how we looked at the committee as we were moving it from Denver to D.C. And this is the coolest job in politics that no one knew existed before 18 months ago.
So I've been talking to a lot of people that I think of as political entrepreneurs over the last bunch of months. What do you think are the characteristics of a strong political entrepreneur?
Well, that's a great question, and it's not one that I've ever answered, so you're going to have to give me a second to think about it. I think in the current political environment, what helps someone who is entrepreneurial and in a political context is the ability to take risks, to actually look at what's been done in the past and say, it doesn't really apply anymore, and we've been limited in our approach for too long. I think the political world has put up some pretty significant barriers to entry for those people who are outside of politics who had a lot to offer. And now I think those barriers are starting to come down. I know as far as this committee, we did hire almost immediately from outside of politics. We certainly have people who are inside of politics, but it wasn't limited to that pool of talent. And I think that's made a huge difference in perspective and how we actually approach solving problems. What do I think are the traits necessary? Vision, commitment to doing the work every day, to embrace a staff that has different skills, a staff that's willing to go back and forth a little bit to prove their point. Because what we do, especially right now for Democratic AGs, is seen on the front lines. It's seen in a fight against the White House. And this committee and the Democratic AGs really are the only ones putting wins on the board. And it's incredibly hard to keep up this pace.
What is the mission of the Democratic AG Association that you're running?
We seek to do a number of things. First, to support the AGs who are in office. And this is by actually developing a policy arm that engages with constituencies in Washington and nationally to talk about the issues that matter. This isn't something that I've seen from the other committees in the 25 years that I've been in politics, and it's something that's incredibly important. The dialogue with your real strategic partners who need to know that you care, and it's not just turn on, turn off. Number two is to provide political support. As you would imagine, for most AGs, they don't have political teams that have been long established or that have worked with them for a significant period of time. You know, this isn't an office that's akin to U.S. Senate, where you've probably run through a fairly significant career already, and you have people that have been around you for that full time. We tend to get people who are running for their first office, maybe their second office, but it's not someone who necessarily has been career track in politics. So we need to provide the support around them that someone in a different office for maybe governor, but mostly for Senate, I think, would already have received. And so we fill in the gaps. The third thing that we seek to do is elect more attorneys general. When I inherited the committee, we had 22 AGs, 22 Democratic AGs. There are 9 states right now that have Republican governors and Democratic AGs. We're looking for new models and for an understanding of how it is that we have ticket splitters for this office. In many states, we've lost ground at the state level, but there hasn't been as much ground lost for Democratic attorneys general. For a series of reasons, there are voters who decide they're going to vote Republican at the national level, Republican for governor, decide to change over and vote for a Democrat for attorney general, but then go back to voting for Republicans. We're looking for answers on why that is. And we've spent the better part of the last year polling and in focus groups, looking at the data a little differently. We don't want it to be a novelty. We want it to be part of our strategy. By extension, we're also recruiting for the first time. And one of the challenges that the attorneys general gave me was that the people's lawyers should look like the people. And for the first time, they will. We have recruited the most diverse slate of candidates that have ever run for attorney general. They're incredibly talented. In many cases, they just hadn't been invited or found the on-ramp to running. By extension, we've launched a program called the 1881 Initiative. And our goal, and it's a public goal, is that 50% of the Democratic attorneys general by the close of the 2022 political cycle will be women. And as we're spending more time with recruiting, we're also seeing the challenges that women face for inclusion at this office. We're not accepting the status quo. It's something that I wish the rest of the party would join us in setting standards and setting goals for what's acceptable. But for us, especially in an environment where we're seeing a sea change in a discussion around sexual harassment in the workplace, there should be a parallel discussion with making sure that we're empowering more women. And we did that before, you know, the news stories were breaking about what was happening. But this is a critically important fight, and it's something that goes to the heart of what I believe in, what our AGs believe, and what our staff believes. The AGs themselves saw that they needed a committee that was more responsive. This political office has behaved differently over time. It's tended to be more bipartisan. So there was a little bit of reluctance to develop a committee that was combative at every turn. And I think that slowed down the process for Democratic AGs deciding to relaunch their committee. Nevertheless, the Republican AGs Association did relaunch it. The Democratic AGs saw a Republican AGs Association that was revitalized, that was raising significantly more money, and it was going after them. As Democratic AGs saw the number of friends in the room decline, they recognized that there needed to be something else happening. I remember getting a call from one of the AGs asking me if I would consider looking at it. And I had a very good relationship with this AG. And of course, I said, you know, I want to do this right away. I'd love to do it. Much of the decision making was seeing a committee on the other side that was going after them.
So does that mean that it's sort of a situation of us trying to play catch up? You know, are we sort of copying what they're doing on the other side? Or are you trying to go past that or be different than that?
We're really using a different playbook. We're not acting in imitation of any Republican committee or Democratic committee. This office has a different set of needs, and we're building a committee specific for the needs of Democratic AGs. The model that we're putting together and we've been practicing for the past 18 months is not one that I necessarily think would work if I were the executive director at the DSCC or the DGA. This is a model that has to work and is based on the needs of AGs and their proclivities and how they engage with the other side. As a political guy, I love to, you know, to step into a fight, and I like to win when it comes to political campaigns. But that's not what AGs need every day. They need a committee that's a little more thoughtful, that leans more into policy in pace with AGs' offices that are changing to incorporate policy to match the litigation work they do. And because AGs have such broad jurisdiction, we need to provide them the resources to address the changes and the needs that they see in their communities or that they see as a group. So while I appreciate the combative nature of the Republican AGs Association, I'm not looking to do what they did. Now, obviously, there are some things that we do have in common. I need to raise more money, and we're doing that. This year will be an historic year for us in terms of our fundraising. And yet, we'll still be outraised by, you know, 2.5 to 1. For the sake of comparison, in 2016, we were outraised 3.5 to 1 and outspent 3.5 to 1 when it comes to the campaigns. We're filling in the gap. We're growing our fundraising. We're spending a lot of time introducing the committee. So while we are in a moment where we've built a platform that is meeting the needs of Democratic attorneys general, we're also in a moment where we've got a Trump presidency and where Donald Trump does not understand the rule of law. And Democratic AGs really are the first line of defense in pushing back and holding him accountable. And that's something that they can do that other offices can't at this moment. Now, we are all hopeful that things will move in our direction in 2018. We're seeing, our data team is seeing that we probably have a 3-point wind at our back. We were active in Virginia and we saw what was going on there, intrigued by what we saw in Alabama. But we know that we need to be looking ahead and we need more partners. And so one of the more interesting things we're doing is we've opened a dialogue with former Democratic attorneys general who are in the United States Senate. There are 6 members of the Senate that were Democratic AGs. We're opening a dialogue with the 1 member of the House of Representatives that's a former AG. We're making sure that we're hand in glove with the DNC. We leaned into the DNC chair election and made sure that the AGs had a role to play in that. We really believe that we can be great players and not siloed in. And so in that way, again, we don't want to be what the other committees have been.
What are some of the biggest races for you in 2018?
2018 is an exciting year for us. We have extraordinary candidates that we've recruited. We're seeing aggressive fundraising on the part of our candidates. Since the beginning of this year, we've been integrating the candidates into our, what we call our AG-only days when we have our policy conferences. And so we very much want to make sure that the AGs have a good working relationship with candidates, and the candidates know and are building a relationship and in some cases mentoring relationships with our AGs. As we look at the map, we thought it was going to be a great map for us. We don't have a lot of states that we need to defend. We have a couple of incumbents who are, for whatever reason, might be in states that would otherwise look vulnerable, but the polling and the experience is showing us that they're actually in a pretty good place. They still have to run good campaigns, but we're more confident. So that means we can go on offense. And whereas our friends on the other side spent $8 million trying to take out Mark Herring in Virginia, we now can look at Republican incumbents that we think are, quite frankly, just bad players and should not be in office, and we can go on offense. And again, we're pretty excited about that. Let's start with Wisconsin. So here's a state where we know that progressives and Democrats have spent a lot of time over the past 5, 6, 7 years, 8 years looking to make gains and have felt the brunt of, you know, Scott Walker. Well, sitting behind and to the right of Scott Walker, you have Brad Schimmel, and he's not a good guy. And so our candidate in Wisconsin, Josh Call, right now is doing his job. He is raising money. He's running a good race. Josh was one of the first candidates that I spoke to, and I'm excited about what he's doing. He's someone that people should be watching.
What is he doing right now?
Well, he's actually, as an aside, he's an attorney at Perkins Coie. He does election law, and you know, as part of their political group. So Josh has been involved in most of the big recounts over the past 5 or 6 years around the country. He's the type of guy we need in this seat. His values are in the right place. He's grounded. He's smart. He will make sure that he's putting the people of Wisconsin before politics, and we're going to be active in Wisconsin. Also in the Midwest, you know, Steve Dettelbach in Ohio. Steve has raised about $1.3 million, I believe. He's been running a perfect race. There are no self-inflicted wounds. And as we talk about campaigns, one of the things that I say over and over again to our candidates, run your campaign well. You're going to get most of your decisions right. There are a few decisions you need to be careful of. And part of that's the managers and making sure that the consulting teams that are around are top-notch consultants. We've been very clear with our candidates that we need to see that they've got highly qualified people stepping in and being around them, and that's just one of those determining factors about whether or not we decide to get involved in a race or a state. We see that people actually have the right people at the table, the people who can actually guide them in real fights. With Sherrod Brown at the top of the ticket, with Rich Cordray entering a field that already has good candidates for governor, we really do believe that the party in Ohio, which knows how to fight, is going to move things forward when it comes to the coordinated campaign. And I think that Steve Dettelbach will benefit from that. We're also making sure that nationally we're supporting Steve, and we get calls regularly from donors in California and New York and Illinois and Florida saying, hey, could you tell me a little bit about Steve? We've heard from Steve. We'd like to know more about him. And every time I get on the phone, I was like, Steve Dettelbach is exactly who we need to be electing if we want to be protecting rights at the state level. And right now, when we don't have the Senate, we don't have the House, we certainly don't have the White House, you need the AG in a state if you want to fend off what state legislatures are doing. And quite frankly, we've lost most of our state legislatures. So there's no more important office in each state if you're a progressive than the state attorney general. We're excited about Aaron Ford in Nevada. Aaron Ford is the majority leader in the Senate. He's putting his law practice on the shelf. He's now finished up his legal work. He's campaigning full time. We think that with the infrastructure that's been put in place in Nevada over the last 2 or 3 cycles, that our candidate there, because of who he is, because of what's there on the ground and the financial support that'll go into Nevada, that he's one of those races that we bring home. In Nevada, we also have a situation, as we do in Michigan and a couple of other states, where we have Republican attorneys general who are now running for governor or running for Senate. And the attorney general in Nevada, Laxalt, another bad guy. When we actually win these states and we put Democratic attorneys general into these seats, acting as the people's lawyers, we actually make up tremendous ground that we've lost in those 10 AG seats that shifted from Democrat to Republican. And we're moving back, and we're going to take back a lot of these seats. We're excited about Arizona and January Contreras. We recruited her to run. She had worked for Janet Napolitano for years. It's a busy year in Arizona, and we think that benefits January. We've got great partners in Emily's List, and we think that LCV is going to be active there. We know that some of our progressive union friends are going to be active in Arizona. So we're excited about the table that's been formed around January. We also love Colorado. Colorado is more challenging because we have a full primary and there's a convention process in Colorado. There are five candidates we like. We wish that, you know, we didn't have five candidates in a race, but we're working with all of them. We want to make sure that everyone has a campaign that's running well so that when they get through the convention, when they get through the primary, there isn't any rebuilding that's needed. So that's a model that we're using across the country, wherever we have more than one candidate in the race.
You ever lean on any of that field, or do you just stay out?
In fact, we're staying in. The approach we're taking is something that I learned from Missouri in 2016. In 2016, when I stepped in, while we were still going to be outspent, we had to be more thoughtful in our approach. And the first marker we laid down was in protecting North Carolina and making sure that Josh Dine was elected Attorney General. Then we moved to Pennsylvania and, you know, looked at how do we guarantee that Josh Shapiro gets over the line in Pennsylvania. And we achieved that. But we knew that both with Carolina and Pennsylvania, we put our best foot forward. The campaigns were running extraordinarily well. We shifted to Missouri, which had a late primary. And historically, DAGA had not participated in primaries. And as we talked about, you know, because it was a part-time committee, even after a primary, there wasn't necessarily a lot of engagement. But on election night, when, you know, we started having conversations with Teresa Hensley about making the next step forward, Claire McCaskill and others had leaned in and said, look, we think you need to, you know, change your team up a little bit. We think you need to add some things. And we felt the same way. The challenge was that the window was so small to get things done. So what we did for 17 with Mark Herring is we were at the table every day with Mark Herring and his team. In recruiting and looking ahead, we've made sure that we're engaging with all of the candidates. They need to have top-notch staff. They need to have staff that understand their jobs. They need to have consultants that can actually help them achieve their aims. And that even if it is a primary, we're helping each of the candidates with their specific needs. So we're actually involved in every one of them, but we keep our conversations confidential. We keep a small portfolio with each one. We don't spend money. We're not publicly going out and endorsing, but we're being helpful. The intention is that when we get through that convention, when we get through that primary, that campaign is humming. Whichever one comes out, we've got a good relationship with them. And then we know that there isn't any significant work that has to be done. They just need to go execute. So in fact, we work with everybody, but we don't put our finger on the scale to tip it for anyone. We do ask that they try to be positive with each other. It's not truly a competition to harm in order to win. But we know that campaigns are, you know, are difficult and people get tired and they sometimes have to push a little bit.
What are the other big ones?
Well, we're excited about Florida. We're excited about Ohio and Michigan. We think that there are some red states in Tornado Alley that are a little bit interesting with the trends. We have a 3-point wind at our back. We actually see Georgia starting to look blue. And so we don't have a candidate yet in Georgia, but we're looking. With the win in Alabama, we think that there may be some things happening there. It's still a difficult state. He still has to show up every day and do his job. It's the South, but we win in the South. So this is one of the more interesting things about Democratic attorneys general and the fact that voters actually look past party if they think that someone actually represents their interests. You know, we've got the AG in Mississippi. We've still got the AG in Kentucky. We obviously have the AG in North Carolina, as we were just talking about it. So we can go win in places that the Democratic Party doesn't seem to be able to win, but we can.
It feels like at least what makes the news out of the attorney generals is a very politicized world where, you know, you have Republican attorney generals suing on Obamacare, or I suspect a lot of suits coming up now on net neutrality or a lot of the big Washington issues. How does that sort out from the standpoint of attorney generals?
I certainly have seen a Republican Attorneys General Association that has been politicized. The Republican Party tends to move in lockstep. And so you've got Mitch McConnell saying during the Obama years that our number one job is in making sure that he's not reelected. Coupled with that, you had now governor of Texas, who is then the attorney general, and Abbott, you know, saying that his job is to wake up every day and sue the president. We don't see the world that way. Our attorneys general aren't looking for opportunities to sue Trump. It just happens that President Trump can't find the rule of law with two hands. And he does not put people around him who value the rule of law. So Democratic attorneys general are forced to act. But we do so with the expectation that attorneys general are the people's lawyers. And if the Republican administration, if they are going to step on the rights of American citizens and citizens in our Democratic AG states, then they're going to respond. That's who they are. Now, with that, there are a set of issues that do go beyond politics. Opioids is a case in point. There are 45 states involved in a set of multi-state actions. When in Ohio, there are the EMS and police and firefighters respond more to drug overdoses than firefighters do to put out fires. We all know there's a problem. And the number of deaths as a result of opioids or substitutes for opioids, when those numbers are significantly greater than the number of handgun deaths every year, we've already tipped the scale. And in this particular instance, Democratic and Republican attorneys general are doing their best to work together in multi-states to address the issue. And I do believe that our friends on the other side care as much about what's happening as we do. And between Josh Shapiro and Andy Beshear, and although politically I don't agree with Patrick Morrisey of West Virginia a lot, I know that he's facing it, as is, you know, DeWine in Ohio. And I think those four states in particular, but not limited to those four, have had to work together significantly more than other states, because that's the epicenter of the opioid crisis.
You know, I can hear that this is something that you're putting your heart into. Can you just talk a little bit about what first got you into politics and got you excited about campaigns?
You know, I don't come from a political family, and I'm the first person in the family that's ever made a career of politics. It's really hard for me to think back about what it was. And I'm going to sound a little sappy, but when I was a kid and my mom would put me to bed at night, she said, you know, I believe in you and you can be whatever you want, even the president of the United States. And I think somewhere that message said that politics is a noble profession. And I remember when I was in college and I wanted an internship in Washington, I didn't know anybody. And I remember being turned down by Republican and Democrat alike. I couldn't get one. And then there was a competition to win an internship through my national fraternity, and there were 175 chapters, and everyone could nominate one person. And so it was this competition, and I went through it, and I actually won it. And there was an internship in the White House that year that was set aside for this. So I couldn't get an internship with any of my state legislators, but I happened to work through this process and got an internship in the White House. So I worked in Vice President Al Gore's office in correspondence for a guy named Bill Mason, who is an old newspaper guy from Tennessee. And that was the first time that I got to ask a lot of fundamental questions about how does this work? And I remember Bill being very generous in his time and talking to me about really basic stuff, but it was stuff that I'd never been able to ask anyone. Then I graduated, and I'd graduated right after the 94 Republican Revolution. So there were no jobs on Capitol Hill. And I remember how hard it was trying to figure out a place to fit in. And, you know, when I came back to D.C. and was knocking on doors and trying to find an opportunity, a number of the people who had been in Gore's office and a few others that I'd met along the way said, you need to go get on a campaign. And at the time, I said, oh, campaigns are awful, and they never say anything, and they're really terrible, and all the things that I sort of picked up from my my progressive professors, I guess we'll call them, the old crusty liberals who were still in higher education, and how they looked at campaigns. But someone gave me an opportunity to get started volunteering on Ben Chandler's campaign for attorney general in Kentucky in 95. And my job was to check media. So, you know, long before we have the opportunities to look at buys now, I had to drive around to the TV stations and the radio stations and actually check political buys. And then I had to find someone who would give me a moment to fax that to the media consultant so the media consultant would look at it. And between running around DC looking for a job and volunteering on Chandler's race, a man gave me a chance, Steve Beshear. He was the former attorney general and former lieutenant governor of Kentucky. He had decided that he was going to run against Mitch McConnell. And in the fall of 95, I was the first kid hired onto Steve's Senate race. Now looking back, Andy Beshear is the attorney general. And I remember there were times when Andy and I had to decide which one of us was driving Steve someplace, you know, for a given appointment. And, you know, it was really great when we got that first bag phone that we put in the car, because I think Andy would drive, you know, for a little while, and I'd sit in the back phone and do fundraising calls with Steve Beshear, and we were between events. And I'd just sort of look over and ask, how do you make decisions on this? How does this happen? I've had a lot of luck. I've worked pretty hard, but I've had a lot of luck in working for great people who would take the time to talk to me about the things that matter. And I hope I do that. I hope I pay that forward with staff and other people who come knocking. At the end of 96, when we fell short against McConnell, you know, there's no worse feeling on a political campaign than losing. Winning feels pretty good, but losing feels significantly more. There's just it's a greater level of emotion in my experience, and you hate it. And so you get your heart broken a lot, but you have to stand up and you have to keep going. And you know, Steve Beshear then became governor of Kentucky. I still consider Steve a mentor, and the door is open, and he continues to be helpful if I have a question. And helping great people get elected, like Steve or like Allison Schwartz. I stepped into her campaign in the 11th hour in 2010, when we had so many Democratic members of the House that were at risk. And I, with her team and her chief of staff, who was extraordinary, you know, we saw Allison not in great shape, and we turned it around, and she was one of those Congress people who made it through. And I learned a lot in that race. But there are so many races, there's so many steps, and quite frankly, so many people to thank who gave me an opportunity or who listened or who let me try things. And I think the confluence of all of those events and experiences and the time away from politics with startups and getting a different skill set with, you know, getting my MBA, I'm applying all of it now in this new environment where every day we have to face opponents who are better funded than we are. We have to face an administration that doesn't understand the rule of law. And I have to ask an incredible amount from my staff and from the attorneys general in terms of working together and seeing the vision of where we can all go if we're an incredible team. And that's paying off. You know, this is a labor of love. And every morning I wake up and I'm excited about the opportunity to get in here and do what I'm doing and keep moving it forward. I also recognize that we don't do everything as well as I want us to do it. But it's all things that I know that we can continue to work on and make better and be a greater resource for the attorneys general. And here's one thing that I haven't mentioned, but is critically important for where the party goes. There's this terrible myth, which is very untrue, that the Democratic Party doesn't have a bench. The Democratic Party does have a bench. No one has been responsible for it. Now I'm responsible for it. I'm the one who has to help these attorneys general become better campaigners, to understand things that may have been a little bit outside of their purview, but they need them now. They need skills built. They need teams built. And by helping them to do this, I know that they will be more successful when they move on, and they will win more. So when we talk about the extraordinary people around our table, I'm very confident that in the next 10 years that we will have at least two that people will consider presidential material. And I'm committed to both. I'm committed to doing what I need to do today and I'm committed to them to get them where they could be tomorrow and make sure that they have an opportunity, because I believe that's the best way to not just to win back the White House, is to make sure that we have the best candidates out there who are doing things on behalf of the people, and we have extraordinary leadership, which I think we're lacking today. I'm ready to put in my work now and make sure that they have a path there.
So, Sean, it's kind of one of the joys of doing this podcast is hearing people who have found a place that fits their calling. It's kind of moving to me. And so I'm really happy. I think we probably first had our first conversation maybe 20 years ago in a very different context. But, I'm really happy that you found a good spot for yourself.
Thank you. And our first conversation was when somebody introduced me to your software. I was a consultant to Ed O'Brien's campaign in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and we were running against Pat Toomey, and we lost that race by 2,000 votes. Now, there's one that if we'd had a little bit more time with Obie, we probably could have changed the course of a lot of things if he had actually beaten Pat Toomey. But that's why we go out and we fight the fight, right?
It is. One question for you, a matter of personal interest.
Sure.
I saw on your LinkedIn that you had involvement in the movie A Sort of Homecoming, a movie I saw and know a little about. Can you talk about that briefly?
A very good friend of mine, Lynn Reed. Lynn and I became friends on the Bradley presidential campaign. And we've been friends ever since. And Lynn had called me at one point and said that she was making the transition out of politics and she was becoming a screenwriter. And she had this script, which was significantly autobiographical, and she was trying to get the movie made. And one of the times that I've been out of politics and I was doing venture capital and private equity work, I helped to set up a revolving fund for a group in Los Angeles to make movies. And many of the investments that I made were around content development, music, TV. So I was around entertainment, but there was the technology piece behind that as well. So Lynn knew that I had that experience. And so she called and asked me if I would participate. And I was excited to do it. One of the things I'm good at is functional translation. What that means is I can walk into a room with financiers and I can speak money and I can do math. And I can walk into a room with elected officials and help to explain things. Or when I was doing a lot of work overseas, if I could go into a room in a foreign country and understand what the interests were around the table and help people to communicate better and moving things forward and in trying to get to whatever that goal was. So with Lynn, it was an opportunity to help her tell her story. And to me, it feels the same as when I sit with Maura Healey, or I sit with Josh Shapiro, or I sit with Aaron Ford, or Josh Call, or Steve Dettelbach, or January Contreras. They've got a story to tell. And so the movie was Lynn's story. And my role as a producer, you know, there were great people who could be on set and who were helping to figure out what needed to be happening there and the capturing of the movie and the production and post-production. Mine was more with making sure that the lawyers and the cast and the people who are around those, the agents and the lawyers on the other side, were communicating effectively, and that when we're making a deal that we had put together the right package and that everything was consistent, so that we knew that once the movie, you know, was made, that eventually on the back end that it worked. There weren't any mistakes. And so if I could help Lynn with fundraising and I could help her with structuring and I could help her with recommending good lawyers to work with and giving her the components of the team, then I helped her succeed. And it's a really interesting thing. It's a fun thing when you see a movie get made and, you know, you've got the opening credits and you see your name on the screen. It's not something that you get in politics. You do the work and you're never really on the screen, but it was fun. And because it was for a friend, it was important too. So I loved it. And, you know, again, it's not completely autobiographical, but I sure learned a lot about my friend in the process of, you know, of making that movie and her telling her story.
And I interviewed her husband earlier on this podcast.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, I interviewed Will, but I didn't ask him about the movie in that context. But I thought it was interesting that the second person connected to the movie is now among my guests.
Well, you know, for Will actually gave my wife her first job in politics. So she's also part of the Bradley family. We met on Bill Bradley's presidential campaign. And she had gone through Bill Bradley's organization. His group was called Participation 2000. Participation 2000 trained staff instead of giving campaigns a financial contribution. So they put the staff there in lieu of that and paid the staff. And Joyce went through that program, and Will was on the board of that program. And then after she finished her first campaign, Will hired her. So, you know, I've been in the Will and Lynn orbit for a really long time. And again, I'm pretty lucky in the people that I've gotten to know in politics and some of their great stories, in addition to the things I've, you know, found on my own.
Sean, it's been lovely to talk to you. Is there anything else you want to say?
Yeah, it's nice to be back in touch. And I hope if there are, you know, things you notice from your perspective about what our committee can do better, about opportunities that we should consider, I hope you'll come over to our table and, you know, and talk to us about it. I mean, one of the things that's very important to me about how this committee works is that we invite people to the table regularly. Almost from the time that I came on board, we reached out to the Congressional Black Caucus, for example. And when I sat with a couple members, I asked them, I said, has anybody from the Democratic Attorneys General Association ever come to your table and ask you to get involved? And they both looked at me and laughed and said, no. I said, well, guess what? You've been invited. And we've done similar things with members of the Hispanic Caucus. And we've continued to make sure that big, beautiful building 15 blocks from us called the Capitol, and all those Democratic members know that if they have things that they need to talk about that relate to work that AGs and members of Congress can do together, that they should come talk to us. And likewise with the other committees, we really believe that we need to be talking more.
So that was Sean Rankin at DAGA. He's at democraticags.org. I'm rooting hard for the success of the work that Sean and his team are doing. We definitely need more Democratic attorneys general. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman for the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found. I would appreciate your subscribing to the podcast and leaving comments on iTunes and SoundCloud and elsewhere and sharing this with friends. And if you have suggestions for people I should interview, please email me at nperlman@gmail.com. Thanks.